thank you. And thank you for inviting me to this amazing place. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this project, which takes place in this scenario. We imagine that you have built up an experiment, and we assume that we don't really know what's happening in this experiment. We don't know how to describe this experiment theoretically, meaning we don't want to make any assumptions on the Hilbert space, the states, and the measurements. So, because we don't want to rely too much on physical heuristics. Then we collect measurement data, and then in the third part, we try to find a quantum model that explains what has happened. We want to find a quantum model that is compatible with our measurement data. And this is the topic of this talk. And this is the overview of the talk. I start with an introduction of the setting that we are working in. Then we will see that the goal of finding a quantum model associated to the measurement data is closely related to finding a Gram matrix that is compatible with the measurement data. More precisely, we try to find a Gram matrix, the Gram matrix associated to the states that you prepare and the measurements that you perform. Then this leads us to questions about the uniqueness of such an estimation. And then towards the end, we will look at the special case involving projective non-degenerate measurements and their post-measurement states. And then I will conclude with a short summary. So what is the setting? I repeat that the setting is that we have built up an experiment that allows us to prepare states that are labeled by W, and it allows us to perform measurements that are labeled by V, and each measurement comes along with outcomes that are labeled by K. And then the objects that are directly accessible to us, the only phenomenological quantities that are accessible to us, are the frequencies associated to preparing the state W, measuring the measurement V, and getting the outcome K. So the frequencies are just the number of outcomes K, given that we have prepared state W and measured the measurement V. And then we divide this total number of outcomes by the total number of runs of that experiment. So these are the frequencies, and these are the phenomenological data that is available to us. And then we collect all these phenomenological data in one big data table, where the entries of the data table are all these frequencies. And note that if we change the row of this data table, we change the state that we prepare. And if we change the column, then we change the POVM element that we measure. So for instance, the first capital K columns are associated to the first measurement. The second capital K columns are associated to the second measurement, and so on. So this is the setting. And then our goal is to find a quantum model that explains this data. Now, before going into this, let us have a look at some common approaches to do so. Maybe the most prominent approach is state tomography, where we assume that we know what the underlying Hilbert space is, and we know how to describe the measurements. And then estimating the states that we have prepared boils down to solving an optimization problem, a convex optimization problem. We can do linear inversion or maximum likelihood estimation or compressed sensing, for instance. Then we have other work aiming at the falsification of target models, meaning that we have some educated guess of what is going on, or we plan to build a certain experiment that describes or that realizes a certain quantum system. And we also then have the fidelity to such target models. So these approaches are of the kind that we have some model in mind, and then we check whether the data is compatible with that model. So it's a bit like a null hypothesis. But we only get information about the relation of what has actually happened in respect to the target model, and we don't get explicit expressions for what has happened. Then we have dimension witnessing, where people aim at giving lower bounds on the Hilbert space dimension, but we don't get explicit expressions for the states and the measurements. And then another direction that is somewhat orthogonal to the topic of this talk is about the construction of reasonable confidence rich in estimators, where we also assume that we know the Hilbert space and we assume that we know how to describe the measurements. It is somewhat orthogonal to the topic of this talk because this direction is about characterizing or dealing with statistical fluctuations, whereas the topic of this talk is more about systematic errors. And a very recent paper was entitled Self-Consistent Quantum Process Tomography, where we assume that we have an educated guess about the states and the measurements, and we know the Hilbert space, and then we linearize around this educated guess to solve the problem. So now let us go to our setting. And we also make an assumption. So all these approaches before, they had assumptions, or they didn't give a complete picture of what is going on. So our assumption, this first step towards the final goal is, our assumption is the asymptotic limit, meaning that we repeat each measurement, each experiment associated to the preparation of the state W and measurement of the measurement V infinitely many times so that the frequencies start to approximate arbitrarily well the associated probabilities. Then we can plug this into Born's rule so that the frequencies become equal to the trace of the density matrix of the state W times the POVM element associated to the outcome K, given that we have decided to measure the measurement V. And these are Hermitian matrices, so we can expand them with respect to some orthonormal basis in the space of Hermitian matrices. So we get a column vector representation of these matrices. And due to the orthonormality of the reference basis, we can now rewrite this Hilbert-Schmidt inner product in this standard form. And now I need some more piece of notation. I need to introduce this matrix P, which contains all of the information that we are interested in. So this matrix P carries as column vectors first all of the states, all of the unknown states, and then we use the rest of these column vectors to describe all of the unknown POVM elements that appear in our experiments. Yeah?
They are unknown, but do you assume that they are IID when you run the experiment?
Yes,
many
yes,
times?
Yes. I assume that you can repeat each experiment independently of each other. Yeah, this is also an assumption. So now we have this matrix P, and then now we can introduce the state measurement gram matrix G, which can now be written in this form, P transpose P. So the gram matrix carries all pairwise inner products between states and states, states and POVM elements, and between POVM elements and POVM elements. And when we do this, then we notice that the data table from before appears as off-diagonal block in this gram matrix, because the data table, the entries of the data tables are the frequencies, and in the asymptotic limit, these entries become equal to the inner product between states and POVM elements. So we conclude that in this off-diagonal block, we have the data table. And here in the diagonal block, we have the gram matrix associated to the states and the gram matrix associated to all the POVM elements. And I would like to convince you that this gram matrix is very close to finding. So if we could find such a gram matrix, we would be very close to finding a quantum model, because this gram matrix fixes all the pairwise relative geometric relationships between all the vectors that are involved in the experiment. For instance, if we had one of these, if we had available such a gram matrix, we could just perform something like Kolesky decomposition, and we could get a representative bunch of vectors. But this bunch of vectors would now not correspond to the original vectors, but they would correspond to some simultaneously rotated bunch of vectors. Yeah?
But, so when you just do something like Kolesky decomposition, mm-hmm. what do you know about positivity of the states?
Yes, exactly. So maybe I should maybe make some drawing. So In the situation that we're aiming for, in the true quantum situation, we know that these vectors associated to the states and associated to the P of M elements, they correspond to positive semidefinite matrices. So these vectors live in some cone that corresponds to the cone of positive semidefinite matrices. Now, if we just do something like the Kolesky decomposition, then we get this bunch of vectors back, but maybe somewhere out here. So we get a bunch of vectors that originates from the true bunch of vectors by a simultaneous rotation of all the states and the measurements. But we don't have a guarantee, and this will basically never happen, that these set of vectors live in the cone. But this should just illustrate that all the pairwise geometric relationships are fixed by the Gram matrix, but we're not yet done, but the Gram matrix just encodes a lot of information about the actual quantum model.
So there's a global rotation that brings everything into
the... Yes. So now before going into computing this Gram matrix, in the computation of this Gram matrix, we note that we have, as a direct corollary, we get a dimension witness. We get that the rank of the data table is a lower bound on the square of the Hilbert space dimension. This holds true because you see that the data table appears as a submatrix of this Gram matrix. So the rank of the data table lower bounds the rank of the Gram matrix. The rank of the Gram matrix is equal to the rank of its generator, P. And the rank of P is equal to D squared. Because these vectors, these column vectors have D squared components. And if you assume that all the states and the P of the M elements span all of the Hilbert-Schmidt space associated with the quantum experiment, then we have here this D squared. And we can even go one step further if you're willing to assume that the state part of this matrix P and the measurement part of this matrix P separately span the space of Hermitian matrices associated with the quantum experiment. Meaning, if we assume that the rank of PST, this is this part of P, and the rank of PM, that's this part of P, if they both are equal to D squared, which is maybe, I guess one could consider this to be a mild assumption, then this implies that the rank of the data table becomes equal to D squared, just by standard relation of ranks of matrices. Because in this case, we multiply full rank matrices, and then we get this equality. So we see that the rank of the data table becomes a convenient dimension. So repeated, our goal is to find a data-compatible quantum model. So we want to fit the quantum model to our data. Now, a priori, there exists a tremendous amount of possible quantum description. Just think about one explanation of our data and embed this quantum description in a higher dimensional description, for instance. So we need a principle that selects a particular quantum model. And the principle that is behind our approach is Oken's razor, meaning that we want to find the quantum description that is fixed by as few parameters as possible. And the number of free parameters in a quantum description is directly linked to the Hilbert space dimension once we have fixed the total number of states and the total number of P of M elements that appear in the experiment. So applying Occam's razor amounts to finding a quantum model with lowest possible Hilbert space dimension. And we have seen before that the Hilbert space dimension, the square of the Hilbert space dimension, is equal to the rank of the Gram matrix. So applying Occam's razor amounts to solving this optimization problem where we search among all the Gram matrices that can be generated by a quantum model and are data compatible. We look for a Gram matrix that has minimal rank. So this is... ideally, we would like to solve this optimization problem. Unfortunately, this is a rank minimization problem, and as such, it is NP-hard in general. So we cannot hope to solve this problem exactly. But maybe we can solve it approximately. And common approach to deal with such a situation is to proceed via convex relaxation, meaning that we replace the original hard problem by a closely related convex optimization problem. And transforming an arbitrary optimization problem into a convex optimization problem amounts to proceeding with to transform the feasible set into a convex feasible set, and it amounts to transforming the original hard objective function into a convex objective function. So these are two steps that we need to take. So let's start with the replacement of the original feasible set. To do so, we choose a maximally allowed Hilbert space dimension. We choose some dimension cutoff, Emax. For instance, we could just choose to use the rank of the data table if we are willing to believe that the states and the POVM elements separately span all of the Hilbert-Schmidt space associated to the quantum model. And then we do the following somewhat rough replacement, where we just take this difficult set, the set of quantum Gram matrices, and we replace it by the intersection of the cone of positive semi-definite matrices with the smallest ball that still contains the set of quantum Gram matrices. So we start off with this difficult set of quantum Gram matrices, which is an element of the cone of positive semi-definite matrices, because its elements are Gram matrices. And now we replace it by the intersection of the cone with the smallest ball that still contains this difficult set. So we replace it by this region. And this is a somewhat rough replacement. But once we have done this, and then we can proceed with the transformation of the objective function, and this transformation is as good as it can get. Because we will be able to replace the rank, the difficult function, by its convex envelope. And to understand what the convex envelope is, I think it's instructive to look at this picture, where the blue function mimics the role of the rank. It has local minima, and as such, it is hard to find the global minimum by computational methods. And to now replace this blue hard global optimization problem, we now exchange it by solving the convex optimization problem associated with this red function. And the red function is, in this setting, the convex envelope of the blue function. It is the pointwise largest convex function that is pointwise a lower bound of the blue function. So you see that this red function always lower bounds pointwise the blue function. It is convex, and it is pointwise largest under these two constraints. So it's kind of the best convex approximation of the blue function if you want to minimize the blue function. And we're able to compute the convex envelope of the rank with respect to our feasible set, and we end up with the following relaxation of our original problem, where we minimize trace over the feasible set given by all positive semi-definite matrices that are contained in this ball with radius MQM, and we demand that the Gram matrix respects the constraints given by our measurement data. And this is not only convex, it's even a semi-definite program. So it can be solved efficiently and robustly, at least in theory. However, keep in mind that we're not solving the original problem. So we're solving some approximate problem. And in particular, we have enlarged the original feasible set. But originally, this was our feasible set, the set of quantum Gram matrices, and now we have enlarge the feasible set by using the intersection of the cone with the ball with radius MQM. So this might we are at risk to having ending up with a result of our computation that is not an element of the set of quantum Gram matrices. Yes.
So what is this radius? You can compute it for.
It's something like the number. So if capital W is the total number of states. So then MQM of D is this total number of states plus total number of measurements times the dimension. So it grows with the dimension. But actually, this radius will be irrelevant when we proceed. So this is possible. Nevertheless, and this is actually a problem in practice. Right? So if we just run this optimization problem, then this happens very frequently. But now let us assume that we were in a situation where the relaxed feasible set, the larger feasible set that contains the original feasible set, was equal to one single element. So we have only one element in our relaxed feasible set. Then we could conclude that the relaxed feasible set is equal to the correct quantum feasible set, the original feasible set, because the correct feasible set is contained in the relaxed feasible set, and it is not equal to the empty set because we have sampled data from it. And if now this, so we conclude that if this would hold true, then we would have this result that the estimation would be automatically an element of the correct feasible set, and we would not have this problem up here. So this is kind of a uniqueness property of the constraints describing the relaxed feasible set.
Can you explain a little more about what is the assumption? Sorry,
So the assumption is an asymptotic limit?
The assumption that the relaxed feasible set is the same as the other set?
If we assume that this holds true,
right, but
then this holds true. But we have not. I haven't argued why this should hold true. This will come now.
Okay.
So this is a uniqueness property of the constraints characterizing the relaxed feasible set, and this will never hold true. So we have this observation, and now we can ask: does it ever occur? Do we ever face such a uniqueness property? And the answer is no. And the answer is no, independent of the Hilbert space dimension, it's independent of the total number of states, and it's independent of the total number of measurements and total number of outcomes. Nevertheless, we want to go,
I mean, if this assumption were true, you wouldn't really have an optimization problem.
Yes, it's just a feasibility,
Okay.
Yes. But this...
Well, it's not true.
No, but we actually want to proceed this way. So we actually want to go down this road and try to find now additional, we now want to find, ask the question whether there exists additional assumptions, reasonable assumptions, maybe in some situations you might be willing to assume that some states are pure. So these are additional assumptions that enter, and we can ask the question whether such additional assumptions lead to such a behavior here.
But is there any, I'm not sure, like, we first relax the optimization and then assume that the two feasible sets are the same.
No, it's assume that this holds true, and then it's a consequence of this that this holds true. And now we're going to check whether we can ever reach by additional assumptions such situations. So for instance, you might assume that some states that you prepare are pure or some measurements are projective. Then these are additional assumptions that you impose on the quantum model.
Mm-hmm.
And these additional assumptions might lead, and we will see that they will lead, to such a situation here.
And the set with the G tilde means the set of all possible quantum gram matrices.
No, this should just indicate that this relaxed feasible set collapses to a particular element. So there's only, it should just mean that we are looking at situations, or we hope to find situations where the relaxed feasible set consists of just one single element.
Okay, so it's a generic.
It's just some element. Yeah. Okay, so. Is this somewhat clear? So we want to, we ask ourselves whether some additional assumptions like the purity of states, can lead to such situations. That's our assumption. So whether that's our question. Can we find reasonable additional assumptions such that this assumption such that when we take into account these assumptions, then we have the property that the relaxed feasible set becomes equal to one single element. And in the remainder, I will consider assumptions that are of the form that we know additional entries of the Gram matrix. Right, so if you assume that the states are pure, for instance, then you know that the associated density matrix has Hilbert-Schmidt norm 1, and then we know that this means that we know that some elements of the diagonal of this state's Gram matrix are equal to 1. So we can encode such properties like purity or projectiveness into adding linear constraints to this matrix that demand that some entries are equal to 1 or 0 or whatever you like. So let's describe our knowledge about this matrix. Let's mark the known entries of this matrix. Let's mark them with an index set omega. So originally we knew these entries of the Gram matrix because we have performed the measurement and we know what the frequencies are. So we know these entries. Now we might assume that we know some additional entries, some entries in here or in here, and we mark the positions of these entries by an index set omega. And now we ask a question whether, given that we know the indices marked by omega, do we get this property back? And questions of that kind are very similar to questions that are raised in a branch of mathematics that is called rigidity theory. And this is a very old branch of mathematics that goes back to Cauchy and Euler. So what we are aiming for is using concepts of that branch of mathematics and apply them here. So let us assume that we start off with some general vectors p1 up to pn that are elements of Rd squared, so they correspond to Hermitian matrices, because the space of Hermitian matrices is this real d squared dimension. Then we again set g to be equal to the Gram matrix associated to these vectors. And again, we mark the entries with this index set omega, as before. And then we ask a question, does this knowledge g omega, so this specific entries that we know and that are marked by omega, does this knowledge g omega uniquely determine the Gram matrix, so all of the Gram matrix? And the answer is the following. We have that this Gram matrix is unique up to discrete symmetries. It is unique if this property holds true. So this is a rank of a particular Jacobian matrix. And if the rank of this particular Jacobian matrix is equal to d squared times n minus 1 half d squared times d squared minus 1, then we know that the Gram matrix is uniquely determined by our knowledge and vice versa. And this is...
So what is the argument that g depends on? Is p the collection of vectors?
P is the collection of vectors, and yes. Yes, it's the same notation as before. Yeah, it's a bit of notation, so it's maybe a bit convenient. Yes, and then we get this necessary and sufficient criterion for uniqueness of the Gram matrix, given our knowledge. And this is the analogon of what has been termed Asimov growth theorem in the context of rigidity theory. But here, note that here we allowed these vectors to be arbitrary, whereas in quantum mechanics, we know that these vectors are constrained to the code. And in the quantum setting, if we now ask a question whether this knowledge G omega determines the true quantum Gram matrix uniquely, then the implication only goes from right to left. So if this property holds true, then this implies that the quantum Gram matrix is uniquely determined by our knowledge, but not the other, but not, so we have this additional cone constraint, so the cone can help in some sense. So the implication doesn't go the other way around, and we will see that later.
The condition has to hold for all p's. It has to hold for all collection of vectors.
All possible, you mean like all possible collection of?
Yes.
It holds for generic p's. If you sample this matrix P from a probability measure that is absolutely continuous with respect to the Lebesgue measure, then you have this property. But there are exotic situations where this doesn't hold true. but for generic vectors, it's not strong. Now, you see that in this criteria, we have this matrix P appearing. So that's maybe a bit inconvenient because a priori we don't know this P. So we could only check this relation once we know this matrix P. But we can actually do better because we can answer this uniqueness question before even knowing P. So before we even know explicitly what P looks like, we can answer the uniqueness question if P is generic. And this leads us to a notion of universality because whatever generic P we get, given a specific pattern, a knowledge pattern, omega, we'll be able to answer whether this gram matrix is uniquely determined or not. And this leads us to rigidity phase diagrams, just called them this way, where we fix the Hilbert space dimension. Here, it's a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And we might assume that all the states that are involved in the experiments are pure. And then we can ask this uniqueness question. And then we see that, for instance, if we have 16 or 15 states that are prepared in our experiments and we have 10 measurements that we perform, then we're in the rigid phase, meaning that the Gram matrix is uniquely determined by our knowledge. Whereas if we are somewhere up here, then the Gram matrix is not uniquely determined by our knowledge. At least in the general setting, in the quantum setting, these are only sufficient but maybe not necessary conditions. So the quantum rigidity phase diagram contains these rigid phases, but not the other way around. And this is just another example for four-dimensional systems.
Can you explain what the figures again? What do the boxes represent?
The boxes represent situations where we are in the rigid regime, so meaning that if we consider an experiment that allows us to prepare, for instance, 15 states, and it allows us to measure 10 measurements, and we have knowledge of that kind, that we know that states are pure, and then we have this data table knowledge, the off-diagonal blocks of the Gram matrix, then if we're in such a situation, then we know that this knowledge determines the Gram matrix uniquely. Whereas this is not always the case.
So measurements now contains different settings and outcomes?
So measurements here mean that the number of outcomes per measurement is equal to the Hilbert space dimension. That's also fixed. Okay. So to answer the rigidity question, you need to fix the Hilbert space dimension, you need to fix the number of states, the number of measurements, and the number of outcomes per measurement. Yeah?
So for pure states, the indices you know are sort of on the diagonal. Right?
Exactly. So
what is the condition for projective measurements?
So, as you said, so if the states are pure, then we have ones in this upper left corner, then we have here the data, and then we have the unknown block associated to the measurements. If you have projective measurements, then they might be degenerate. So if they're degenerate, then we have this unknown block up here that is associated with the states. Then we have again the data transpose. And then we have something like this that we don't know the diagonal because we don't know the degeneracy of the measurements, but we know that the associated POVM elements are orthogonal. So we can add some zeros. It's a bit small picture. Can you see it? So maybe I should magnify it a little bit.
There's a button you can push the boards around. There's a button down there.
Ah, this is the middle one. So let's have here a magnifying glass. So let's say this is now a block. This block corresponds to the measurement 1. This block corresponds to the measurement 2. And then a priori projectiveness means that they could be degenerate. So if we don't know the degeneracy, then we don't know the diagonal, but we know that the POVM elements are orthogonal to each other. And so we know that, for instance, the first POVM element is first, second, first, second. We know that the first POVM element is orthogonal to the second one, so we can add here a zero, and vice versa here. So orthogonality of all the POVM elements means that we can add here all these zeros. So in this picture, I assume that the, so in this right picture, which is about projective measurements, I assume that they're also non-degenerate. So I also know that here we have ones. But we can, so in this way, we can encode these properties by fixing some entries of these gram matrices. Is that okay? So we saw that to fix the situation, to have a uniqueness, we had to make additional assumptions, which is a bit unsatisfactory, maybe. But now let's have a look at projective non-degenerate measurements and their associated post-measurement states. Recall, this many times, that the gram matrix is of this 2 times 2 block matrix form. And then let's assume that the measurements are projective non-degenerate and the states that are involved in our experiment are post-measurement states associated to projective non-degenerate measurements. Then we have that all the states are equal to the associated POVM element. So if we measure a particular POVM element, then we know that the post-measurement state is equal to the POVM element that we have measured. And if this happens, and taking into account again this orthogonality of the POVM elements, then we see that the data table that we see is of this form. We have these identity matrices appearing on the diagonal of the data table. So this is now a consequence of the assumption that we assume projective non-degenerate measurements and post-measurement states. But the nice thing, I think, is that we can go the other way around. We can have a converse, meaning that if we assume that the Hilbert space dimension is D, and we assume that the data table is of this form, then we can conclude that we have this property that the post-measurement, that the states that we look at are equal to the POVM elements. And from this, we conclude that the gram matrix associated with states become equal to the data table, and they're again equal to the gram matrix associated to the measurements. So we can recognize these situations phenomenologically. And to determine the associated gram matrix, we don't need to do any computations at all. We can just read it off from the data.
Question. When you talk about the data table, do you mean an equivalence class of data tables under permutations of rows and columns? Because if I don't know, how to label my states, I wouldn't necessarily find that data table, but rather some...
So you mean like... you can now have random permutations of the rows and columns. Yes. So if you cannot associate the post kind of yeah if you don't have that so yeah the result says that if you have this structure then you can do this, but if you have these random permutations as you say, then it might be hard to recognize this structure. That's true. So this is maybe a hard problem to find. To have just taking a data table that in principle would have had such a structure, it might be hard to recognize such a structure if it's kind of messed up. But the converse only says that if you see this, then you can do this, the other thing. But it doesn't give you a procedure to go from the randomly permuted situation to this situation. That might be a difficult, I don't know. I haven't really thought about this. It might be a difficult problem to check whether a given data table can be transformed into such a data table. But I don't know. Maybe it's also easier. It's a bit like this bi-clustering problems. But I don't know. So, OK, so I think this situation is much more satisfying that the generic situation from before. But I guess in most scenarios, in the end you want to write down explicit density matrices and POVM elements. And for this, we have designed a heuristic algorithm that I cannot explain here that takes the state measurement gram matrix as input and then starts to search for explicit density matrices in POVM elements. But I don't have time to describe this here. So let me now conclude with this summary. We started off with gram estimation guided by Occam's razor, and this has led us to a rank minimization problem, and this was a computationally hard problem. Then we have relaxed this hard problem, and we have observed that we are at risk of getting something that cannot be reproduced quantum mechanically. Then this has led us to this uniqueness analysis, which I think is of independent interest, to know when does knowledge determine the quantum situation uniquely. Then we look at this special case of projective non-degenerate measurements, and we saw that we can recognize phenomenologically such situations. And then I just mentioned that we can find these density matrices and POVM elements like quantum mechanically. So we can find quantum mechanically valid density matrices and POVM elements by a heuristic procedure. Yeah, with this, I want to thank you for your attention. But maybe before we really stop, maybe I can have kind of demonstration in the qubit case. This works. So now I assume that we know the diagonal of the gram matrix. We assume that all the states are pure and the measurements are rank one projectives. And we sample now random states, random measurements. And from the data that we get and from the knowledge about the diagonal, we want to reconstruct all, or we want to find representative density matrices and POVM elements. So we can run this procedure. And the procedure consists of these two phases. In the first phase, we want to estimate the gram matrix. This is what's happening here. I mean, it doesn't really say so much now if you just see this output. But just to illustrate, so in the first phase, we want to find the gram matrix. This is what's happening here. And in the second phase, we want to find these explicit realizations. This is what's happening down here. And then that's not so, maybe it's a bit irrelevant. But now you might be interested in explicit estimations of density matrices. For instance, in this setting, we find a representative density matrix. In this qubit case, we find a representative density matrix that is of this form. And now we can maybe check whether inner products are correct. So we can look at the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product between the first density matrix and the third density matrix. Then you get this. Now we can check whether this inner product is correct by looking at the correct entry. And you see it's this. So they're not exactly equal because I stopped the search for realizations at an error of 0.01. So they're not exactly equal, these inner products, but they're equal up to this error where I just stop the algorithm. So just as you see, it's not all just hocus pocus. There is really the code behind it. So yeah, so thanks for your attention.
Do you have any more questions for Sarah? No? So I'm wondering, in the case where you either park in the asymptotic limit, so you really just have some relative frequencies that have fluctuations of the asymptotic probabilities, or maybe somebody gives you some probabilities that don't come from a quantum experiment, and the task is to maybe come up with an explanation that's yield something close to the statistics.
Yes.
So like maybe I give you a constraint. I want a two-dimensional explanation of these statistics. What's the best you can give me? So have you thought about how to tackle that sort of problem?
So you start with data that is not perfectly quantum.
Right. So I'm imagining an experimentalist might get some data, say, I'm going to presume that I know what my Hilbert space dimensionality is, but I know what my system is, how would I want to come up with my best guess as to what the density operators and POVMs are in this experiment. But there may be no set that yields precisely the data table that is registered.
So at the moment, I just have an algorithm in mind, a heuristic algorithm that searches for approximate pictures. But it might be hard to give error bounds. This is just a starting point. I think we can do much better.
What sort of technique are you?
It's techniques that are similar to the ones that I used here to search for representative density matrices and POVM elements. But yeah, it's on the to-do list. But I think it's hard. It's maybe hard to give error bounds. But maybe this is just the beginning. So.
If this is the beginning, what comes next?
One thing is certainly the non-asymptotic limit. And Rob mentioned, fitting effective. The title is maybe a bit misleading. So starting with something that is truly infinite dimensional. And now fit the low dimensional description to the truly infinite dimensional case. I think it's somewhat clear that kind of the task, the goal here is very fundamental, right? So it's a very fundamental task to start from data and fit the quantum model to it, or a physical or classical model, if you like. It's a very similar problem. So the task is very fundamental, and there are many, many approaches. There are many questions that you can ask. Also, what happens if you start with a non-IID situation? How close is an IID situation? There's many things that you can try. Maybe the questions are hard to answer in a rigorous way, but it's easy to play around a little bit with algorithms and heuristics and see what comes up. Yes?
Have you thought about the case where you have certain symmetries?
No, not yet. But yeah, of course. Yeah, all of these things they need to be investigated. Yes.
Here you use now the Occam's razor to say basically we want to use a minimum dimension. That's basically the clear-cut goal. I see that nicely working if you really basically have infinite statistics, right? Because there is always a clear physical model behind it. But I thought that the moment if you could talk about we have finite dimensions, finite number of runs coming into that game, that then always basically it becomes a kind of fitting problem, right? And then it depends on the number of parameters you're offering to your system, right, to make it fit better or worse, that there's a completely different aspect, new aspect coming to it.
Where is
the one thing is basically to make a good fit about something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the moment you have finite number of data, right?
Yes,
and the question is how well can you fit it? And typically, I would expect that basically the larger the dimension of the Hilbert space, the easier it is to make a fit because you have more parameters.
So
it's no longer the clear cut what is the goal to minimize, so you get a trade off situation between minimizing dimensions and getting better fit.
Yes,
any idea what might then play a role?
Of
the thing which guides you what is optimal? Before it was clear, and now at the moment, now it's clear.
So you
minimum
mean how to choose a Hilbert space dimension?
Yeah
that's okay. I'm working on this. But this is a somewhat well-defined problem. So it's a trade-off between complexity and fit. Yes?
So I have the impression that what you're doing must be related somehow to self-testing.
I think I don't know what, I'm not familiar with that.
You assume that it's IID, so I think that's why it's not a self-testing scenario.
Remind me what the self-testing scenario is. Well, that's why it's my question. I don't really know what self-testing is, but I have to.
I think the first versions were IID, trying to get away from that more recent work.
can you it is very similar. Remind me, what is the self-testing paradigm?
Paradigm is where you don't trust your measurement apparatus. So how does it work? Oh, right. So within each experiment that you do, you don't assume anything. But then in between experiments, this is our early work, we assume that everything would behave the same as it did in the last experiment. But we wanted to get rid of that, but that's a pretty hard assumption. So some recent work seems to have done that or something very close. So we don't, it is very similar, because we don't want to assume anything about the sources, the measurement apparatus, or the gates in between. So, well, our work built up to testing gates as well. But the first vanilla version was just, you built on testing EPR pairs in the Myers-Yao paradigm, which is very similar, right? So somebody gives you a state. Well, another thing with self-testing, right, is you were given a hypothesis. Somebody's claiming this is an EPR source, this is a measurement in these bases, now you go and verify it. In your case, you don't even have a hypothesis. You're supposed to find the hypothesis.
Yeah.
Self-testing makes it a bit easier in that it gives you the hypothesis, and then your job is to
confirm
that it really is faithfully implementing that hypothesis.
See, also differences whether you can influence the procedure, or you can ask how to test, what things to run. You can try to go for the right direction, while here you just get God given some signals,
right.
Some measurements, and you have to deal with it. While in that case, you really try to look for settings where you get anti-correlation, stuff like that. I think.
Well, no, we don't assume. Well, so in the initial version, we did assume bounds in the dimensions, but we wanted to get rid of that. In the later work, doesn't assume bounds on the dimensions.
Yeah, here is quite a number of assumptions. It's not like.
Well, I was thinking I wanted to discuss these connections with self-testing with you offline, because there's a lot of material to go over to see how related they are. But I guess the main distinction is in self-testing, we don't give you a hypothesis. We give you a hypothesis, and you're not. So in some sense, yours is harder.
It's harder, but the results are also weaker, I guess. It's much weaker, I guess, because, yeah, there are assumptions underlying this, like IID-ness, and that you trust your dimensional weakness.
Self-testing is a very paranoid paradigm. You know,
it's
really a multi-prover interactive proof system. It's one way of formulating it, where the apparatus is the provers. They're the provers. And the person running the experiment is the verifier. Configures the apparatus, says go, do the experiment, and give me back the data. That you can formulate it as an interaction between the experimenter and the apparatus. And in the version we initially did, within each experiment, you could be as paranoid as you like. The provers could have prior entanglement and conspiracies, but you'd run that experiment, get the data, and then do another experiment. And we assume no memory or entanglement in between experiments. Some of the more recent work in interactive proof systems, I think, allow you to be even more paranoid and allow more entanglement, conspiracies between the apparatus, between all your apparatus.
I guess you would be very much unsatisfied with making such assumptions. So it's a different. I guess you aim for a different kind of rigorous, maybe,
a higher level of paranoia. We're trying to reduce the trust assumptions as much as possible and still get something. Still be able to do physics. Right?
Yeah. So in this sense, this is much weaker. Right? So
this. What did you call that theory? Rigidity.
Theory.
So that's a new tool.
Maybe I didn't stress this enough. Also, that it gives uniqueness up to discrete symmetries. So it gives uniqueness. So you can ask a question whether your state measurement bunch of vectors, your bunch of vectors that represent the states and the measurements, whether it can be deformed continuously or not. So this it only answers this question. So in principle, there might be discrete symmetries, mm-hmm. like mirror symmetries. So I hide this in some footnote somewhere. Yeah. So I mean, this is really just a brief sketch. So I guess from the crypto point of view, we should be careful. So
literature on solving the classical analog of this problem? Is the classical analog of this problem trivial?
No.
So I have some sources of, you know, there's probability distribution and some response functions, and I don't have any guarantee about any of them.
The classical problem is also very hard. It's very similar, right? So here you are given some inner product constraints that are determined by the data, with the pairwise inner product constraints between states and PLVM elements. And then you want to find vectors living in this complicated cone of positive semi-definite matrices that are compatible with these constraints. And in the classical case, the cone looks a bit easier at first, they're orphaned, but yeah, it's still hard. If you just have this pairwise constraints, it's very hard to fit these vectors into the code. It's actually, I think it's even shown that this is something like NP hard. But I have to look this up.
So are there classical results which approximate the solution in a way similar to what you've done here?
I just recently found out that there are Berg going in that direction. Maybe I can show you.
I just remembered another important distinction, another important tool. So it's like one of the assumptions we make in self-testing is a locality constraint.
Mm-hmm.
With a local structure, and it's something we do here commutes with something we do over here. Mm-hmm. So it's an extra assumption, I guess, the kinds of assumption you're
talking about. Yes, but somehow this seems to be related to the I shouldn't be expecting it, but maybe.
I mean, the way I see, you just have these vectors, and you know, there's no local structure here, as far as I can.
Yes. Yeah, not
like
the
sensor product structure.
Yeah. No.
There's no idea. That's
yeah. Well, that's
much.
That's another.
So the local self-testing is usually based on sort of that inequality.
Yeah. So that's why we need the local structure.
Yes.
Otherwise, you can't.
But here, there's no structure.
Right. That's. It's another big distinction.
But maybe you can somehow just transform one picture into the other. But
a kind of assumption you could add to your model that people would be satisfied with.
Yes, but maybe it's a hard constraint. I'm not sure. So the locality constraint seemed, at first it seemed somehow not like an easy constraint, but I'm not sure. But I think it would be interesting to look.
Direction you can go with this is if you try to explain a certain data table sort of with a classical theory,
mm-hmm.
Then if you can find a way of expressing constraints on that classical theory, such as locality, non-contextuality, then you have a way of thinking about NOVA theorems. You know, does this data table violate Bell inequality? Well, it's a question of whether it can be represented as a classical model with certain
mm-hmm.
features or not.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's okay.
Let's thank Cyril again.